You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Wales is a country in the United Kingdom. Like Scotland, it's part of the same island as England and shares a complex history with the other parts of the UK. Karen went looking for someone to help us learn more about monsters from Wales, and she came up with artist Cole Ellis. Cole has a new book out in July called Welsh Monsters and Mythical Beasts, A Guide to the Legendary Creatures from Celtic Welsh Myth and Legend. It's a simply gorgeous collection of art depicting monsters from Welsh folklore, along with a short prose tale about each of the illustrated creatures. I believe in the interview that we thought the book was going to have a July release, but it looks like on Amazon that they're saying it's going to be out in August. Regardless, it's a book that you can pre-order right now, and you're going to want to snag it if you're the sort of person who likes beautiful illustrations of monsters or knows someone who does.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, Cole Ellis. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
I am a fantasy artist from Wales, and I specialize in depicting mythical creatures from different cultures, but my main focus recently has been on Welsh mythical creatures.
Your art's gorgeous.
Beautiful.
Karen, how did you find them?
We like to look at monsters and cryptids and creatures all around the world, and we've spoken to people about Irish monsters and English monsters, and we thought it's about time we look at some Welsh monsters. So I just Googled Welsh monsters and you came up.
Well, there you go.
That's brilliant.
So it all worked out. And, your book is just beautiful. We really need to urge our listeners to go and check it out, Welsh Monsters and Mythical Beasts. And I believe it's just being released now?
It's coming out on the 2nd of July this year.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, it's pre-order. I see the pre-order link now.
You can pre-order it from most bookshops.
Yeah, which is perfect, I think.
Yeah, so we'll have a link in the show notes so you can go pick this up.
Cole, how did you become interested in monsters and what motivated you to write this book?
Well, I think I've always been really interested in mythical creatures ever since I was a kid. Just anything to do with monsters and mythology and dragons, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I loved reading The Hobbit when I was a kid as well. And as I got sort of, I was a teenager, I was introduced to Lord of the Rings as well, and I absolutely loved that. But yeah, I noticed when I was going on holiday to places like Iceland or Norway and stuff, I was seeing so many books on the local mythology. And a lot of the time when people come to Wales and they go to the tourist spots here, you don't really have that much. There's some, and that what's available is good, but there isn't that much that contains a lot of art and visuals to go with it. So I thought that, you know, that somebody needed to create something that when somebody is visiting Wales, they could learn a little bit about the mythology and the culture.
If I wanted to go to Wales, where would I go? Where is Wales?
Wales, it's a part of the United Kingdom, and it is on the west coast, sort of between Ireland and the England.
Gotcha. Okay, so we'll put a map as well.
That's fine.
Well, I was joking. I'm from New South Wales in Australia, Sydney. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah, Welsh is a really interesting language. It's been endangered for quite some time now. I have read about colonization and the English basically trying to stamp out the use of Welsh and all kinds of punishments for kids and things like that. But I think, yeah, we just wanted to talk a little bit about the Welsh language before we get into these.
Sure.
Yeah. For us, difficult pronunciations of some of these dragons.
I'm a learner myself, so I'm not a fluent speaker, but I can definitely help with the pronunciations.
What kind of monsters are in your book, and how did you make the selection on what to include?
It sort of started off as like a small project where I was sort of just documenting Welsh mythical creatures. And at the time, I worked for this company called The Night Shop in Conway. And we had an awful lot of customers coming in. And when they sort of got wind of what I was doing, because we were sort of talking about it, more and more people were sort of coming in with local stories. And they're like, oh, have you heard about the Avanc? And I was like, oh, no, I haven't heard about that one. And they sort of came in with all this information. They said, oh, you have to look this up. And they just kept bringing things in every so often. I was like, oh, there's so much here than what I realized. So I just started writing it all down. I was thinking there isn't anything available which sort of documents these specific creatures, and it would be so cool to have like a little guidebook or something. So I kickstarted like a small guidebook, and it did way beyond what I expected it to on Kickstarter.
Nice.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And then after that, it just kept growing. I had more and more people then sending me messages going, oh, there's one from my local town. Oh, there's this one and this one that, you know, I hadn't even heard of. And I was thinking, oh, I could make an even bigger book. So a couple of years later, I just decided to sort of redo it properly, like as a bigger book with more things in. And I did that again on mm-hmm. Kickstarter, and it did even better, which was a huge surprise.
Wow.
And then I got in touch with a publisher in Canada called Eye of Newt Publishing, and they wanted to publish it, basically. So it sort of spiraled. It sort of started off as like a little sort of hyper-focused passion project, and it just sort of spiraled out of control. But in the best possible way. It's just been fascinating to see how many people were interested in Welsh mythology, and just how many people abroad were really interested. There's been a lot of people in the US, in Canada, in Norway as well, surprisingly, who've wanted to learn about it.
Yeah, so there's so much interest in folklore right now, which is great. And I like that people are keeping, even in this digital age, it's actually helping keep the stories alive mm-hmm. and spreading them all over. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's the thing. A lot of these stories were either told by word of mouth, by sort of local people, or they were very fragmented. So I was sort of traipsing through books and things, trying to piece together what little there was of each legend. Some of the pages in the book aren't very long. There'll be like a couple of passages, because that's literally all I could find on that specific creature. Whereas others have got like a whole page or two pages dedicated to them, because I've been able to scrounge all kinds of little snippets of information on them. But again, it just depended what I could find. And the thing is, I'm still finding more. So I definitely, there'll definitely be more stuff in the future, I think. But this is what I managed to find at the time. Yeah, maybe.
It's such a beautiful book, and it needed to be written. So it's fantastic. You're the person to do that. And I think we should start talking about some Welsh monsters. And when I think of Wales, I always think of the Welsh flag and the beautiful red dragon on the flag.
Yeah, I think it's the one that most people would associate straight away. If you know where Wales is and what Wales is, you would know of the Red Dragon, or a Draigoch, as we call it. But the interesting thing is that there's so many other types of dragon associated with Wales that people wouldn't necessarily have known about. There's the story as well of the red and the white dragon. That's usually the first one that people are introduced to. At least that's the one I learned about in school. But I didn't know about other sort of dragon-like creatures in Welsh mythology. There's the Avanc, there's the Gwibir, there's cockatrice as well, or Celiog Nedir. I think I pronounced that right. People will probably correct me, but that's okay. which is basically like a cockatrice.
Let's assume our listeners haven't heard about the Red Dragon. What is there like a classic story about this creature? Like, why is it associated with Wales?
There's quite a long history as to sort of how the Red Dragon ended up on the flag, and that's sort of a separate story. But one of the main sort of legends in Wales was that there was a king, King Vortigern, who was trying to build a castle in this sort of area of North Wales called Dinas Emrys, which is near Bedgellert. I don't know if anybody's been there. It's usually quite a popular tourist spot, but people really like to go there because it's quite beautiful. And basically he's sort of trying to build this this fort on the mountain, and the fort keeps falling down. And I'm going to try and say it, hopefully I've pronounced it right, it's Merlin, who is basically Merlin, discovers that there are two dragons sleeping underneath the foundations in a cave, and they keep fighting. And there's a red one and a white one, and they sort of escape and get out, and they start flying around and attacking each other. And basically the red one eventually sort of wins out and sort of scares away the white one. And that was sort of a prophecy almost of the Welsh sort of fighting off the Anglo-Saxons. So that story is probably the most famous one to do with the red dragon.
So I didn't see this in the list, but when I think about monsters of Wales, and I'm not sure this is even exactly a monster, but it sort of is the Pooka.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was a really interesting one, because I hadn't heard about that one until I started writing the book, and somebody sort of came to me with information about it. It seems to be more of an Irish legend, but there's a lot of crossover between Irish mythology and Welsh mythology, and this is definitely one of them, because it's sort of pronounced the same way, it's sort of spelt differently. So in Ireland I think it's spelt with an O, and in Wales it's spelt with a W, so it's P-W-C-A.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Neat. And I think they're very similar creatures. They're like a shape-shifting creature. It kind of, nobody really knows what its normal form looks like, but some sort of say that it looks like a lemur with wings or something, with these sort of long fingers. The only thing that sort of gives them away apparently is that they have red eyes, or jet black or bright white fur. But they are absolutely fascinating.
Have you ever seen the American movie Harvey?
No, I haven't, sorry.
It's a Jimmy Stewart comedy, and I don't know what year it came out, but it's a black and white. But it's about a guy who's become entangled with a puka, and it's he's the only person who can see it, and it, okay. he sees it as a human sized talking rabbit, and it's a very very funny movie, but it introduced me to the puka as I must have been like 7 or 8 when I saw that movie. I just loved it.
Who's Harvey?
A white rabbit, 6 feet tall.
6 feet?
6 feet, 3.5 inches. Now, let's stick to the facts. Well, anyway, I was walking down along the street, and I heard this voice saying, "Good evening, Mr. Dog." Well, I turned around, and here was this big 6-foot rabbit leaning up against a lamppost. I thought nothing of that, because when you've lived in a town as long as I've lived in this one, you get used to the fact that everybody knows your name.
In most mythologies, I think they like most shape changers, they are tricksters. They like
exactly.
to teach you lessons and play pranks on you. And yeah, they're quite interesting characters.
A creature that I was interested in looking through your book that's, I guess, related to the dragons, and I'm sure I won't be pronouncing this correctly at all, because with Welsh, spelling and pronunciation don't always seem to match.
The Gwybyr.
The flying viper.
Yeah, it's a Gwybyr.
That's a terrifying looking creature.
they're basically like an adder, or like a British adder. We don't have that many venomous snakes here in the UK, but the only one we have is an adder. So they were sort of quite feared. And the idea of a Gwybyr is an adder that has grown absolutely enormous and sort of turned into a dragon. So it's sort of, it's grown wings, it's grown in huge venomous creature, basically. And they are quite, quite scary. I've been to the area where one of the legends comes from, Penmachno, and that whole area is quite spooky. It's quite sort of overbearing, and there's all these trees and this deep ravine. So you can definitely see how that inspired that legend.
The Gwybyr of Penmachno. There's a valley in Wales called Wybrynant, which means the Valley of the Gwybyr. In that valley, there lived an aged and monstrous Gwybyr, and the people in the area were quite afraid of it. A man named Owen, whose name also was Owen the Prince, heard of the monstrous winged serpent and decided to try and defeat the beast. But he was not a fool, and he decided to seek the wisdom of an old wise man named Rhys Dywin, whose name means either ardent wizard or perhaps fire wizard. Owen went to the old man and asked if he stood a chance in battle against this beast, but the old man eyed him up and down and spoke a prophecy, saying that if Owen tried to fight the Gwybyr, it would surely bite him and he would die. Well, this was a grim foretelling, but Owen was not sure that he could believe the old man's prediction. So to test his powers, he put on a disguise and came back the next day dressed as a peasant and asked once again of the old man, "If I combat the Gwybyr, will I prevail?" "No," said the old man. "If you fight this beast, you will surely fall and break your neck on the rocks of the valley." Confused by this new prediction and still somewhat racked with doubt, he came back a third time the following day, this time wearing the outfit of a miller, his clothing dusted with flour. "Old man, tell me truly, if I go and fight the Gwybyr, will I win?" "No," said the old man. "If you go and battle that beast, you will surely be cast into the river and drown." Now Owen felt his confidence surge. Surely this old man was a fraud, for he'd come to him 3 times asking for an augury, and each time had been given different horrible fates. With that in mind, he went off to the valley to fight the beast. Emboldened by his new sense of confidence, he surged into battle and was quickly bit by the poisonous beast. In shock, he stumbled backwards and then tumbled head over heel down the valley into the walls and rocks, breaking his neck, before finally rolling into the river, where he quickly drowned. Some say that Owen's friends, upon finding his lifeless, drowned body, ganged up and tried to kill the Gwybyr, only to see it flee down into the river, where it can still be found today from time to time, looking up from the watery depths with malevolent eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting just reading about them and how they prey on fish and sheep and goats and even people.
Yep.
Yeah, a flying adder. Yeah, that sounds terrifying. A lot of people already have a fear of snakes, as we've talked about frequently on the show. And then add in flying is, that's an unnecessary modification.
Extra powers.
I'd like to register a complaint.
I think that's one of the most common legends across Wales, actually, because I know that they were also sort of talked about in South Wales. And I believe that there were delays to building Cardiff International Airport because people didn't want to disturb the Gwibbias that lived in the field.
Well, you don't want them flying into the engines. That'll mess things up.
So. No.
Wow. And so, they were up to 40 feet in length.
Mm-hmm.
These are really big. This is not just like...
Oh, yes. Oh, you can get really tiny ones and really big ones. They just keep growing.
That is amazing.
Little baby ones. Cute ones.
Do people spot them? I mean, do people see them today?
Some people say that they do.
Okay.
there's always going to be an elephant. I know in Iceland, some people are very, very.
I know where you're going with this. Yeah.
protective over areas where there's elves. There's certain places you're not allowed to build roads and things like that. And I know there's definitely areas here where people, where they are very superstitious and they do definitely believe in these things. So. And that's why I thought it was very important to be respectful when depicting them.
Do you think that that's a generational thing, or do you think that it really crosses age brackets and that it's kind of a mythology that's just really steeped in the tradition of the country?
I think a lot of it is sort of steeped in tradition and sort of word of mouth. I know that on Anglesey, the Isle of Ynys Môn, a lot of my friends have sort of talked about these sort of little folk tales that they were told growing up. And it's like, oh, don't go near the rivers or the ponds late at night because a Llamhigan Adur will get you. And there's all these little sort of folk legends and things associated with Halloween as well, sort of growing up, that they would sort of tell me about, that they would sort of do sort of every year. So there are these little folk traditions and these little sort of word of mouth things that get passed down.
What was that creature that you just mentioned?
They are basically like frogs, but they can grow absolutely enormous. Again,
Flamiganadur, or the water leaper, is an amphibian, large frog-like creature with bat-like wings and horns. Its youthful form still sports a tail. There are lots of stories of these clever little animals stealing food from fishermen sitting on the banks of waterways, but they also have a darker side and are said to attack and devour small livestock like goats and sheep or even domesticated pets that come too near the water leaper's habitat. According to folklore, you can kill these monsters with conventional weapons, but if you see flying horned frogs while visiting scenic Wales, it's probably best to give them a wide berth and go fishing elsewhere. Could you say it again?
Llamhigynadur. I'm hoping I'm saying that right. So normally you would, like with dur, you would roll your R at the end, and I can't. I just can't do it, unfortunately. So
I used to live in rural Australia, and there was a town called Armidale in New South Wales, and there was a little town nearby. A lot of Welsh names.
Yeah, interesting.
And Welsh people who'd moved out there too, but this little town was Llangollen, with a double L. And some of the
there's a Llangollen here.
Yeah, I'm sure it was named after that, like lots of parts of New South Wales. But it's a very interesting language, and certainly the place names can be quite a mouthful.
Well, a British weatherman has become a social media star following a report he gave this week. Check out this tongue twister.
Now today we had a big contrast in temperature across the UK, just 12 degrees over coastal parts of eastern England with cloudy skies, but in the sunshine in northwest Wales at RAF Mona, just up the road from Llanfair Pwllgwyng, Llantysilio Gogogoch, the temperature got to 21 Celsius, that's 70 in Fahrenheit.
Did you catch that? A sentence, not a word, right? Well, that was Channel 4's Liam Dutton nailing the pronunciation of the Welsh village with a 58-character name.
I don't know why the colonials all wanted to rename new places with the old names. That's so strange. Like, I can't imagine going to Mars and I'm like, aha, this is New Kennesaw. What?
It makes it quite interesting when you're sort of Googling or looking up the town where you live. Like if I type Bangor, which is where I'm originally from, if I type that into Google, it'll come up with one. I think on the coast of England, but also in America somewhere.
Exactly, in Maine. Yeah.
So it's just like, oh, so which one do you mean?
Uh-huh, exactly.
There's three different ones to pick from.
And the one in Maine is Stephen King country. Yeah. Yes.
And I think it's adventurers going to places and saying, oh, this reminds me of this particular place. And seeing similarities between places. But yeah, you get that so much in Australia and in America too. Lots of places named after English towns and cities.
It is amazing how much we reuse the names. And again, these monsters, you know, the whole category of dragon, you know, has got a kind of a global footprint.
Definitely
talked about that before. But you also draw a lot of fairy type creatures. Can you talk about some of that a little bit?
I did for this book.
Yeah.
it was absolutely fascinating, sort of looking into those, because I didn't realize that there were so many different types of Welsh fairy. They are sort of under an umbrella term. I'm hoping I'm going to say this right. It's Twith Teg. And they're basically the fair folk, and there's different types of fair folk. There's some that live in the mountains, there's the elves, there's mine fairies, there's fairies that live in your house, and there's ones that live under the water and mountain dwelling ones, and they're all quite distinct and interesting and vary quite massively in size and appearance. I think one of the ones
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww. Yeah.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to ask about the mines. Would these be coal mines there?
Yeah, mostly
coal mines or
coal and slate and gold. I think they sort of took this one over to America when they went over. It was called a bucca in Welsh, but also known as a knocker.
Oh, the Tommyknockers.
They'd knock on walls to sort of warn you about that you were getting a bit too close to their nests, or that the cave was about to cave in. They would sort of apparently knock on the walls to sort of warn you that that's going to happen.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting how that legend sort of went over to the US.
It is. There's a lot of really creepy mine lore. Yeah, it's a creepy job. So, yeah, and dangerous.
Being absolutely.
We should do a show on that.
Yeah, it's quite scary.
A lot of my fears, though, like this show is. There's a running theme on the show of this show is based on things that scared the crap out of us when we were kids. And Karen,
that's how it started. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Karen and I both read a lot of, you know, spooky books when we were growing up. And I remember one I read was Amazing Real Life Coincidences. And there was a whole section in there that had coincidences around people being in mines and hearing voices telling them stop, go, 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 get out now, you know, that kind of thing. And it's like it saved their life, but they have no idea whose voice mm-hmm. it was. And I love those stories because you don't know if they're real or not. But also, like, some people say that in times of crisis, you can, your own subconscious can be telling you to do stuff that's sound advice, but it doesn't feel like it's coming from within you. Like you've become disassociated from yourself in this terrible, scary time.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the truth is, but I do find those stories fascinating and creepy. So
you're making me think of a friend when I was in high school who was traveling on a bus one day at somewhere in Sydney and heard a voice screaming in his ear telling him to get off the bus right now. Mm-hmm. So he did. And absolutely nothing happened. That was it. He couldn't find the source. I mean, there were people around him who were asleep or on their phones. So he didn't know where it came from. But yeah, absolutely nothing came of it. So I always just think about that story as just the kind of mundanity of these kinds of coincidences. But I'd imagine it'd be a pretty creepy thing to have something like that happen. You'd think it would have to be an omen of some kind.
That's quite creepy.
When I was looking at your art, I noticed that you had a creature that I've seen before in some kinds of festivals, and it's this horse-headed creature or horse skull.
Ah, yeah, the Mary Lloyd.
Yeah. Wait, yeah. Have you seen those? Have you seen those in live reenactments or live festivals or anything?
I haven't yet, unfortunately. I was meaning to finally go last year, but unfortunately I wasn't able to make it. But it's something I really want to go and see. I've even got my own horse skull in the studio. It's sat right behind me. And that one is it's more sort of associated with South Wales, but there is an Ysmon Mary Lloyd as well, which sort of comes out every year. So I would absolutely love to go and see it and go and sort of take part in the festivities and things.
What are the festivities like? I mean, I'm assuming most of our audience has probably never even heard of this creature, but I don't want to put your art into our show notes, but I'll put a link to your page so people can see what we're talking about here. But it's a sort of a human in the reenactments or whatever these festivals are. It's a person in a costume with a giant horned horse skull on their head and robes and stuff.
Yeah, sometimes it has horns, sometimes it has bells hanging from it. Sometimes they'll put mistletoe around its head or holly or rowan berries. It depends on what sort of significance necessarily sort of goes with what they're celebrating or what they're trying to do. Sort of rowan berries would be seen as a sign of protection against sort of evil spirits and things like that. So you could make sort of crown of it over the top of the creature. Basically it's a person with a pole, with the skull attached to a pole, and they sort of articulate the mouth with a string with a white sheet over them. And there's a couple of different ideas of where this came from. There's a couple of different legends as well that surround it. One of them was that it was the mare that was sort of kicked out of the stable when Jesus was born. They sort of kicked this mare who was about to give birth out of the stable so that Mary could. Basically, she's wandering the land trying to find a safe place to give birth to her foal. And that's probably the saddest one that I've heard. Sort of other ones were sort of like... again, that sort of plays into how she sort of knocks on doors and she's trying to gain entry to get food, and if there's the, like this sort of back and forth between people, so she'll sort of sing a song and the people around her will sort of sing a song, and then the other person in the house will have to sing one back, sort of saying why they don't want to let her in, and then eventually there's this sort of back and forth until eventually you have to let her in, and then you just have sort of like a party in your house. It's usually done in a pub these days, though.
Well, the morning, the word, God bless you, and the new word, the oven, I'm gonna, the oven, I'm gonna, the oven, I'm gonna, the gunny.
Just love the illustrations, and I'm looking at the pictures of the water fairies now, and I find them really interesting. It seems like they're predominantly women.
Yeah, you definitely get male ones as well.
You can. Well, yeah. What I found interesting is that they're actually kind of wise women or mm-hmm. cunning women or healers as well.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
What's quite interesting is that they would teach people things. So a lot of the time when people came across these sort of water fairies, they would teach them skills, or they would, again, sometimes they would marry into human families, and the children that they had would end up being quite intelligent, or end up becoming doctors or physicians and things like that. And again, it might be one of those things where they'd explain someone being sort of remarkably talented or exceptional as being part fairy.
You mentioned the book, The Mabinogion. Is that right? Mabinogion?
It's basically it's two different books. So there's the Red Book and the White Book, which again will sound quite familiar for if you're a Tolkien fan. And there's there's two different books, and basically they are a collection of stories from Welsh folklore, sort of including an awful lot of Arthurian legend. A beautiful illustrated version of the Mabinogion by Alan Lee.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. One of the artists who worked on the Lord of the Rings films.
Yeah.
And his artwork is absolutely gorgeous. I've got it as part of my collection as well.
I'm looking at the mermaids now, so the Morgan. Can you tell us a little bit about them? And are they related to other kinds of mermaids in other cultures?
It is very, very similar to sort of mermaids from other cultures. These are a little bit different. Sometimes they're sort of like mermaids, and they have tails. Sometimes they don't. They can, again, they're kind of shapeshifters. Some of them, these ones are sort of particularly associated with being able to manipulate water, and they can sort of associated with floods and heavy rain. Apparently, they were sort of renowned for sort of having relationships with fishermen and then sort of leaving the babies on the shore for the fishermen to raise. And then when the child reached adulthood, they would return to their family in the water, which again, is quite similar to the sort of Selkie legends from Ireland.
So they grow up and then they go to school. Okay, it's another pun.
Yeah. It's fish school, yeah. And so you talk about their villages as well, as they're decorated with jewels and with coins and crystals.
Yeah, they'd be sort of described as having these very, very ornate underwater cities, which was a fascinating thing to research and to look into, because I didn't know about any of this before I started looking into it and reading about them.
And I'm too shiny, watch me dazzle like a diamond in the rough. Strut my stuff is so shiny. Send your armies, but they'll never be enough.
Oh, I gotta know. Okay, I feel terrible because like every one of these I can't read. It's like I see the letters, but they seem intimidating to me. The boar, the giant boar.
Now this one I do really struggle to pronounce, and I don't know if I'm just trying to dig him out. Where is it?
Looks like Torch Truth almost. That's
Turth, I think. Again,
that sounds plausible.
If people would correct me, that would be great. Because again, I am a learner. I'm not a fluent speaker.
This is...
So
no worries. It's better than we could attempt. Yeah.
I was fluent as a child, but it's something which unfortunately I moved away when I was about 6 years old, and then sort of moved back to North Wales, and I'm now living in North Wales again now.
Was it your first language?
No, English was my first language, but I went to a Welsh school, so it was all Welsh speaking. So it made it interesting then going to an English school, speaking Welsh and getting very confused.
Mm-hmm.
This was an Irish prince that later became a total bore.
Oh, no.
But he sounds like, I mean, the picture you've drawn, he's like pierced with arrows. And it says his razor hair is like poisonous. It sounds like quite a curse.
He's sort of covered in these poisonous quills that if they sort of brushed against you, they poison you. And he's sort of talked about in the Mabinogion, the collection of stories. I think he's mentioned in the Red Book of Hergest.
Yeah, it says he was actually, I guess, driven out by King Arthur himself. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Driven off a cliff. Well, that's very biblical. Yeah, that's something.
Another creature I was interested in, and again, that I can't pronounce, that the Angel of Death.
Oh, yeah.
Engilistor.
And
but it seems like it's a Halloween legend.
Yeah, and Gelistor. I think that's, again, hopefully I said that correctly. that one's quite a scary one that I found out. That's not too far. That's in the town of Conwy in North Wales, where it's basically this mm-hmm. there's this old yew tree, which is apparently a portal to another world. And each Halloween, this sort of angel of death, this spirit would come out of the tree and sort of make its way into the church and sort of stand at the pew and just sort of like recite all the names of the people who were going to die that year. So there'd be this sort of people would sort of dare each other to sort of go to the graveyard and sort of wait to see if anything happened. And there's this particular story of a man, I think called Sean, who again, went to the graveyard and saw it and sort of and had his name called out and died sort of within that year. So it's quite a few stories surrounding that, which are quite scary.
And is that a popular spot for legend tripping today?
It was very much sort of like a local legend. And sort of people would hear about it from word of mouth, and occasionally there'd be like little books that would mention it as well. There'd be this one book called I think Rumours and Oddities from North Wales, and I think it's mentioned in there. And there's just like little hints about it, but you wouldn't necessarily know unless you spoke to local people and they told you about that particular story.
I think it would be a very popular thing if there was a legend like that around here. And it makes me think too that at some point these legends could be resurrected, certainly through your book as well, and with people starting to tell them again and to share them and maybe to do that kind of thing, which is good for tourism.
I know that there's a lot of tourism around Conwy, but yeah, I wouldn't recommend it. I don't think I would be brave enough to go. I know they do Halloween walks and things every year, and I think they actually do include the graveyard in those Halloween walks. But yeah, they normally leave before midnight.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
Mm-hmm.
I like the black dog.
A Gwilgi.
Okay. So the second G's hard.
Whiffkey.
Okay. Yeah,
whiskey.
But this fits right into black dog lore all over England. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess all over the UK for that matter. It's a pretty
There's definitely a lot of black dog legends from around the UK.
I love your artwork though. You've incorporated like what do they call it, triskelons and spirals and stuff into the stonework. That's nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's like some traditional like Celtic symbols in there, old sort of Britonic symbols, which I thought was quite fun.
It seems like you have kind of alien big cats as well, which
we
get a lot of stories of those in the States and in Australia too.
Mm. Lots had a lot of those
folklore
recently.
And urban legends about.
Mm.
Oh, interesting. Oh,
yeah, a lot of people seeing pumas apparently. That's been, I think there's even a website dedicated to it called Puma Watch, where people can report sightings of pumas in North Wales. It's been quite interesting watching what's been going on.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, we've certainly dealt with that a lot on this show too. And I know in Australia that there were stories of or claims that American soldiers had brought pumas into the country during World War II and just left them there, or mascots, and maybe that they'd brought along. Claims of the thylacine everywhere in Australia still.
It's one of those animals I really want to still be alive. I feel pretty confident that they were wiped out. But
it would be nice if they were still
they're
here.
They're so interesting. I'm fascinated by all of the marsupials. They're such interesting animals. Mm-hmm. And except we have in America, we have the opossum, the Virginia opossum, which I think actually came up from South America. But I think that's the only marsupial that got stuck here. On the Americas when Australia decided to go on a walkabout.
Fee, fi, fo, fum. Fee, fi, fo, fum. Hee, hi, ho, hum.
Did want to ask about the giants, and I'll let you pronounce.
The Koori. those are fascinating. Yeah. Absolutely fascinating to look into, because they varied so dramatically in size. All the different stories I found about them, they could just be a very, very tall human, or they could literally be the size of a mountain. They could use a mountain as a throne. Sometimes they were shapeshifters. They had like a sort of more monstrous form, or they had a more humanoid form. They are, again, they're mentioned in the Mabinogion as well. They have quite a mixed, like a lot of the creatures in the book, they have a mixed sort of type of stories that are told about them. Sometimes they're described as quite barbaric and monstrous, and others describe them as having interesting culture and having, you know, being skilled warriors and poets. So there's a very big distinction between, like, you can see where sort of Christianity sort of came in and started sort of retelling some of the stories and sort of demonizing some of the creatures. So there's sort of this shift in tone sometimes when you're reading about them. Sometimes they're described as very intelligent, very fascinating, that they'd be sort of like quite helpful towards humans, and then there'd be these very, very dramatic differences where they'd be described as demons, and you see that in the story of the Cain Conanun, which are the hounds of the Anun, and that is the origin of the hellhound legend. These sort of spiritual hounds that would follow the wild hunt with the sort of the fairy kings from Anun, which is the Welsh otherworld. The closer they are to you, the quieter their barks would be, but the further away they were, the louder they'd be. So you wouldn't necessarily know how close they were. They'd sound like they were leaving you alone, but then they'd suddenly be on you, kind of thing. And that was scary. That was a really interesting one to learn about, because I didn't realize that had sort of inspired the sort of hellhound narrative.
Hounds are interesting because we see them as pets, and that's really an easy way to think of them. But in less civilized times, it wasn't unusual to run into wild hounds. And if you've ever been pursued by wild dogs, it is an unpleasant experience. And we have the word...
I can't say that.
We've got the word hounded, and we think of it that way. It's still in our language, but it's not an experience most of us have had. But I still remember like running into packs of bad dogs. It's not good. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. That sounds scary.
Matt, my husband was out using a ski-doo or something in Colorado, kind of northern Colorado during winter, and was attacked by a couple of very hungry, thin, mangled-looking coyotes, or coyotes, whatever you prefer. So, yeah, he has a scar on one of his hands from that attack. But, pretty frightening thing to happen. Yeah. Ever had anything like that? Touch wood?
No, we don't really have that kind of thing here. So it's not something we really worry about, to be honest.
I didn't see Gog Magog mentioned in your book, but that Welsh giant lore is quite famous. And I guess that is actually shows up in Geoffrey of Monmouth's history, Regem Britannia.
I don't think I've actually heard of that one.
Gog Magog. I couldn't talk about giants in the UK without throwing in a little background on the story of the giant known as Gog Magog. There are two stories about the giant's name's origins, but it seems likely that it comes from a Welsh tradition originally and so therefore merits a mention in this episode. The giant Gog Magog is mentioned briefly in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, which was compiled in the 12th century. Now, despite its name, the book's actually a rather fanciful collection of hero narratives and royal accomplishments, and is now seen more as a work of literature than history, though it was long considered to be factual during its history as a reference book. In the story, there's a wrestling match between the giant Gog Magog and Corineus, a companion of Brutus of Troy. For those of you who are into researching how nationalist narratives tie ancient myths to far-flung nations, the character of Brutus is attempting to tie England with ancient Troy the same way that the Romans themselves claimed that their history lay there. It's also similar to how Joseph of Arimathea is claimed to have gone to Glastonbury. Corineus fights Gog Magog in a wrestling match and tosses him off of a rock in order to defeat him. Gog Magog represents the last of the giants that those heroes found living in the country of Albion, which we now call England. The name Gog Magog sounds suspiciously like the characters Gog and Magog mentioned in the Book of Revelations. However, this itself seems to be a corruption of a reference in the biblical book of Ezekiel to a man named Gog from Magog. So if this is the correct etymology, the man from a place becomes a single name in Revelations and then becomes the name of a giant in English folklore. However, an 1860s annotated version of Monmouth's book above, by Manly Pope, suggests that the name Gog Magog may have been a corruption of the Welsh name Gar Madoc, or Madoc the Great. Regardless of the true origin, this legend was enough to inspire me to imagine a giant mechanical beast that could be activated during times of need to come to the aid of England, and I imagined that this monstrous construct might be housed in the tower that currently holds Big Ben. And so I named it Cog Mech Cog and had an artist illustrate it. It's just a bit of silliness, but since I spent my 5 spot to have it drawn, I'm throwing it in the show notes for your amusement.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. I'm still sort of learning about all these different legends, so whenever something else pops up, I'm not that surprised.
Well, it's a gorgeous book. Oh. I think our listeners are really going to love it. So each entry has some text and then this gorgeous artwork. Is there going to be any supplementary stuff? Are you going to like sell any prints from the book or any, or, you know, kind of get it on a mug or whatever? So.
I do have a couple of prints available on my website, so if people go over to my website, they can find a variety of shops there where I sell some prints with different mythical creatures on them.
Outstanding.
Great.
I would love to drink from Mary Lloyd. Sorry.
I don't think I've got any mugs.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
That's a good idea, though. Cole, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
At the moment, I've been sort of taking a little bit of a break and working on my portfolio, sort of learning how to draw people a little bit better. But I'm also working on a project which specifically explores Welsh dragons and dragon-like creatures. And it's literally called Welsh Dragons. And that is what I'm working on at the moment. I'm also working on a project with my publisher, which hopefully will be announced soon. I'm just sort of ironing out the contract with them at the moment. So unfortunately, I can't talk about it just yet, but it will be something to do with dragons, particularly British dragons. And that will be hopefully getting announced soon, which is quite exciting.
We'll stay tuned. Good luck.
Thank you.
For sure. So we'd like to... We like to finish out our interviews with this terribly unfair question. What's your favorite monster?
I think one of my favorites is definitely the Gwybir. I think because it's probably one of the most scary, but it's also one of the ones that I really enjoy drawing because I quite like drawing reptiles and snakes and scales and things like that. And I think, yeah, the Gwybir is definitely one of my favorites.
And remind us, that's the one that's sort of toad-like or...
That's the one which is a snake. That's
Snake that flies. Yeah.
I also quite enjoy drawing the cockatrice because I like giving them quite derpy looking faces, like quite funny eyes and funny expressions. I can sort of just imagine them being quite bird like or quite chicken like, and just being quite funny.
Nice.
Yeah, and those are good answers and ones we haven't had on the show before. That's special.
Absolutely true. Well, I thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. I think our listeners are really good. They're going to love this.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with Cole Ellis, author and illustrator of Welsh Monsters and Mythical Beasts. A link to the book's pre-order page is in the show notes. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as When Things Go Wrong, Legends of the Old West, and Food with Mark Bittman. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, why not take a minute and thank Karen on social media, because she put a ton of work in making this one happen. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks for putting us in your ear holes like Mesopotamian ghosts.
Monster House presentation.